Good evening and welcome to the latest in the Research Group on Constitutional Studies lecture series. The Research Group on Constitutional Studies organizes research and teaching at McGill at the boundaries of political science and political theory, philosophy, and law around the questions of the values, institutions, and principles of a free society and of constitutional government. The RGCS lecture series, supported by a generous gift to McGill from the Aurea Foundation, supports bringing current research and current leading researchers working on the questions of those values, institutions, and principles into student life, and in particular making them accessible in a way that they are not in the normal run of things to undergraduates and master's students who are too often excluded from access to the research and researchers who come through a research university like McGill. Tonight we are very fortunate to be joined by Aaron Delaney, who is Assistant Professor of Law and courtesy Assistant Professor of Political Science at Northwestern University, and this semester is the visiting Fulbright Chair in the Theory and Practice of Constitutionalism and Federalism, a recurring visitorship that we host at RGCS and in the Department of Political Science at McGill with the support of the Department, the Faculty of Arts, and the Fulbright Canada Foundation. Professor Delaney holds a JD from New York University Law School and an MPhil and PhD in political science from the University of Cambridge, where she studied federalism and constitutionalism. As a lawyer, she clerked for Judges Guido Calabresi and at the Supreme Court, David Souter, prior to her academic appointments at Columbia and now at Northwestern. She's the author of numerous articles on comparative constitutional reform and comparative constitutional transitions and federalism across constitutional systems. She brings to bear political science on questions of law and the judiciary in a way that nicely exemplifies the kind of work that we try to encourage and support in RGCS, and we have been delighted to have her here for half of a semester so far. Please join me in welcoming Aaron Delaney.
Thank you very much, Professor Levy, and thank you to the faculty, the graduate students, and the fellows of the Research Group on Constitutional Studies who have been so warm and welcoming that I may never leave. So you have that to look forward to. So my work looks at judicial power, particularly how courts interact with other players, institutions, and participants in a federal system in order to ensure and promote themselves. But today, I want to focus on a slightly different question. I'm interested in what courts do on their own. What are the internal mechanisms for protecting their legitimacy? So we will start with a story, right? Story hour. 1952, Ruby Elaine, white woman, marries Ham Say Name, Chinese man. They go to North Carolina to get married because they can't get married in Virginia because there's a statute in Virginia that says a white person may only marry another white person. So they go to North Carolina and get married. They return to Virginia and set up house. Time passes, 1953, things are falling apart in the marriage. Ruby decides to file for divorce. This is the 50s. There's no no-fault divorce. So she has to allege something. She says adultery. And then she notes, wait a minute. There's a Virginia statute that says if I leave Virginia to get married to someone who is not white, the marriage is invalid. Virginia is very good. They cover all their bases. So she says, I'll add this to my claim, an annulment of the marriage. Goes to trial. Trial judge sees the annulment proceeding, doesn't even bother with the adultery. Why would you? It's too complicated. Annuls the marriage. 1954 is a very important year in the United States. It is the year of Brown versus Board of Education. So the Supreme Court hands down a unanimous decision saying that segregation in education is in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Segregated schools are inherently unequal. In case you didn't know, I think probably everyone does, it didn't go over well in the South. This was not a successful decision. Things were tense. Back to Virginia. So Ham Say Name decides to appeal. Why? Does he really want to stay married to this woman? No, probably not. But he's in the process of getting a visa, and he's married to an American citizen. And he has a very clever immigration lawyer, and his immigration lawyer says, let's take this. This will be our test case. Anti-miscegenation will head up. Brown just came down. This is a winner. So he gets to the Virginia Supreme Court. And this is important, okay? What does the Virginia Supreme Court say? On June 13th, 1955, it says, in no uncertain terms, no uncertain terms, the anti-miscegenation statute does not violate the U.S. Constitution. Why does it not violate the U.S. Constitution? Well, first, states' rights. Marriage is a states' rights issue. Secondly, preservation of racial integrity is within a state's rights to ensure as a matter of the welfare of society. Does it address Brown? It does, directly. It says, well, Brown's about education. We know that's important to states too, but that has to do with citizenship. And this has to do with marriage. Marriage isn't about citizenship. And by the way, 28 other states besides Virginia agree. It even mentions another case, a Supreme Court case called Bowling versus Sharp, which comes down with Brown and finds the DC school segregation unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause. Supreme Court of Virginia takes care of that too. So now we have under the Equal Protection Clause argument and the Due Process Clause argument, statute is fine, no constitutional violation. Is this clear? Crystal clear. Why does this matter? Why am I belaboring this point? I'm belaboring this point because in the 1950s, if a state Supreme Court said that you did not have a federal right, that your federal right, they struck it, they said no, you got an automatic appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had to hear your case if you wanted them to. And they had to give an answer. Was the state court right? Is there a right? Or is there not a right? Does the statute violate the Constitution or does it not violate the Constitution? So you can imagine things in the Supreme Court, and we know now, you know, it wasn't pleasant. They're sitting around the conference table, Justice Frankfurter is saying, oh my gosh, we can't decide this. What are we going to do? We're going to threaten Brown. We're going to threaten everything. Because if racists don't like school children intermixing, sex is a whole nother problem. What are we going to do? So what does the court do? The court sends it back to Virginia with a per curiam opinion that says the inadequacy of the record as to the relationship of the parties to the Commonwealth of Virginia at the time of their marriage in North Carolina and upon their return prevents us from understanding this and considering this case in clean-cut and concrete form, please find some more facts for us. So Virginia Supreme Court gets this back and they say, no. Didn't we just say it was crystal clear? And anyway, we don't have a way of sending this back to the trial court for more facts. That's not how we work in Virginia. Frankly, or anywhere, that's not okay. So they say, no, we're not going to do it. It's crystal clear. We're denying this federal claim. And they send it right back up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, and I quote, the decision of the Supreme Court of Appeals of Virginia leaves the case properly devoid of a properly presented federal question. Really, Supreme Court? Right? Really? Really? Okay, so what was the Supreme Court's choice here, right? They follow the principle elaborated in Brown, and they strike down the anti-miscegenation statute, right? That's the principled thing to do, as we'll find out in a minute. Or they uphold it, and they give validity to the anti-miscegenation statute. They don't want to do that. They also don't want mass uprising and more pandemonium threatening Brown. So they dodge. That's what happened. They dodged. And in its wake of this decision, the famous legal scholar Alexander Bickel attempts to justify the court's actions. So he said what the court was doing by avoiding this explosive issue was the passive virtues. And the court was forcing a dialogue. It was pushing things along. It knew where the country was headed, but just couldn't rush it there. It would build up over time, and over time it would be able to enforce these laws. And he said, the court exists in the tension between principle and expediency. So we start with name in this story because it presents the trade-off in the starkest form, and it sets off the debate. So the problem with Bickel's efforts to justify this decision, what the court did, was that it was very clear that the court knew what the correct result was, that it followed necessarily from Brown, but it was too afraid to apply it. And so because this issue of principle was so obvious and undisputed, Bickel is castigated. Gerald Gunther says, I mean, this is law, right? He says, the Bickelian approach required 100% devotion to principle 20% of the time, which probably kept Bickel up at night. You know, this was harsh criticism. But rooted in these arguments is the idea that it is something that one, it's through principled decision-making that the court gets its legitimacy. But the context of this case shows maybe there's more, that Bickel's intuitions are correct. There's something that goes beyond principled decision-making. The rule of law is important, but in a modern society where rights are at issue and those rights are debated, more goes on. It can't just be principled decision-making. It's also recognizing that institutional legitimacy is a complex concept for a complex and in a complex society. So Tony Cronman, he understood Bickel to be advocating prudence, and he said, this idea, this identification of prudence as a value, as a political and a juridical value, was the most important element in Bickel's political philosophy. But that was then, and this is now. And we know a lot more now about judicial decision-making and institutional legitimacy. And we also know that the U.S. Supreme Court has become more sophisticated in using what I'm going to term the modern passive virtues. And comparative analysis can shed light on the possible range of choices that courts have to promote this institutional legitimacy. So we don't have an updated assessment of the modern passive virtues, how they're used and how we should evaluate them. That's what I'm hoping to do in our remaining 45 minutes. I'm going to talk about legitimacy, candor, the United States, the European Court of Human Rights, and in conclusion, I'll present a modest argument in favor of passive virtues and look forward to your taking me on. So let's start at the beginning, right? Let's start with institutional legitimacy. There's a lot of exciting work done, and I recommend it to you if you're interested in this, about why societies create independent courts in the first place. It's a burgeoning area of literature, and there are lots of reasons. Elite entrenchment, to ensure the durability of political bargains, a way for political actors to avoid controversial decisions, they all like to do that, insurance against the ups and downs, the vagaries of politics. And it's difficult to distinguish between the creation and the continuation. And I'm gonna try to do that, but they are obviously linked. So let's talk about where it all began. The ratification of the U.S. Constitution. prominent opponents writing under the name of Federal Farmer and Brutus, they worried about the potential power of the judiciary. And in response to these critiques, Alexander Hamilton writes the famous Federalist Number 78, in which he says the judiciary will always be the least dangerous branch because it has neither the power of the sword nor the power of the purse. The famous line, which should ring in your ears immediately when you hear Federalist Number 78, is neither force nor will, but merely judgment. Seems funny now, but actually, when you think about it, why does it have any power at all if all it has is judgment? Part of the story is why it was created, right? That link I was talking about. Who wants the court? How are they going to use it? But also, institutional legitimacy is derived in part from the substantive legal decisions that are tied naturally to the normative legitimacy of law itself. And the substantive legitimacy that comes from judgments rests on principled reason giving. It's why judgments are so important. For a long time, this concept was supported by what's now considered a myth of concept of legality, right? The idea that decisions can be dictated by law. There's a mechanistic application of law. Neutral principles of decision-making mean that people can understand and follow along, and we're all together in this constrained and clearly unfolding development of the law. The legal realist movement undermined this pretty effectively, right? Show that judges' personal preferences and ideologies play and affect their decision-making. How much? Well, that's the whole game and the question, and lawyers and political scientists fight. Political scientists, a lot of them like to say it's all attitudinal. You know, it's what Justice Kennedy had for breakfast in the morning. Lawyers disagree. There are important constraints that are provided by legal reasoning that do limit judges. Text, doctrine, aspects that differentiate legal reasoning from pure political analysis. At the same time, when you might have heard the fact that Chief Justice Roberts called it calling balls and strikes, that's what he does, calls balls and strikes, that's maybe overstating the case. Maybe more of a soccer referee and yellow cards. But either way, right, something else is likely going on. There are hard cases where the law runs out. So let's return to the idea of legitimacy. How much work does this myth of legality or concept of law do to promote institutional legitimacy? At a broad level of generality, where there is commitment to the idea of a court, that idea of the rule of law does some work. Political scientists have noted that over half of Americans reject the view that judges are just politicians in robes. See that they do something else. That said, even more people accept that part of what high court judges do is not clearly dictated by enacted law. The more you know about the court, the more you know that ideology matters, certainly at least at the margins. Political science has shown this, thus that there's some principled decision-making matters, but something else might be going on. So why does this matter? Well, Gibson, Caldera, and Spence have shown that there's a substantial relationship between support for the merits of the decision and the assessment of whether or not the decision was based on principled decision-making or on impermissible politics. What does this mean? If you agree with the outcome of the decision, you think it's principled. If you disagree with the outcome of the decision, you think something else impermissible was going on. So this complicates our story of reasoned decision-making providing institutional legitimacy if people on the ground don't actually buy it necessarily. If their willingness to understand a judgment is complicated by their own normative preferences, then substantive legitimacy has to function within a broader social legitimacy. So for a court to have what people call effective authority, which is a mandate to render judgments for a particular polity and to engender compliance with those judgments, the court needs this broader sense of legitimacy. Many people turn out to be contingent compliers. Group A will comply when they disagree substantively because they believe that groups B, C, and D also believe it necessary to comply and will also comply when a decision goes against them. This willingness to comply is what's known as diffuse support for the institution. So Easton has called it a reservoir of favorable goodwill that helps members to accept or tolerate outputs to which they are opposed. And it's contrasted with specific support, your specific support for a particular decision. Now, reserves of diffuse support can get depleted. If one group is persistently displeased, for example, so Gibson has shown how the US Supreme Court decisions in the 1970s and 1980s ended up undermining support and loyalty among African Americans. We don't know exactly how diffuse support gets undermined. The relationship between specific support of an individual court case and diffuse support is not clear. The current literature is complicated. Some scholars argue that unpopular decisions erode the legitimacy of the court. Think maybe in the American context of Roe versus Wade. Others suggest that it's ideological incongruence. The longer you have ideological incongruence with the court, the more likely it is that the legitimacy or your support for the court is undermined. Gibson and Caldera, the leaders who do a lot of this work, they suggest actually that if you look at Bush versus Gore in the United States, it doesn't have an impact. So maybe specific cases don't have an impact, or maybe the court already has so much legitimacy that it can weather the storm of a Bush v. Gore kind of decision. Now, it's complicated to use the United States to get an overall assessment of this, right? The U.S. in 2000 has a lot more legitimacy or diffuse support build up than it even did in 1955. But we get an idea, and we understand that it's not merely about principled decision making and the results of what the court produces, but there's something else going on. The court needs to ensure compliance as well. So why do we care? Why all of this about courts? Why are we building this institutional legitimacy anyway? We are building it to use it. This is the assumption of the constitutional model, right? This constitutional model. We're expecting courts to play a veto player role. We want them to be counter-majoritarian. Now, the question you all leap to, of course, is, well, when, how? If they're building up all this goodwill, when do they use it? If it's counter-majoritarian, isn't that anti-democratic? How do we feel about this? Maybe the whole thing is terrible. And I recommend that you read some of Jeremy Waldron's work, if that's what you're thinking. If you're not thinking that, or if you would put those thoughts to aside and stay with me in the world in which we're living in right now, which is one in which we have constitutional rights and constitutional courts. And let's think about what it is they can do and if they can even do what they're supposed to do. So assume for now that a court should have this role, that it can have this role, and that it will use this power if it has it. So what's a court to do? Judgments matter. But on divisive topics where the law runs out, where there's debate in society, best choice, you avoid adjudicating the difficult disputes. So the alternative title to this talk is avoiding adjudication. How do we do it and why? Judges must be attuned to questions of the possible, what is feasible, how do we engender compliance? And that's a sense that Martin Shapiro has written that he's gained by practical experience in politics and in the complexities and uncertainties of the human condition. And Bickel was right. Legitimacy is more complicated. Other courts around the world, there's detailed research on South Africa by Brian Ray, Mexico by Jeff Stanton, and I'm going to talk about the European Court of Human Rights. These courts have all acted strategically to protect their legitimacy, often by avoidance. In some cases, you may not be able to avoid hearing the case, but you can at least avoid a substantive ruling on the particular divisive issue. So if all courts face this kind of institutional legitimacy crisis, they're likely to employ some kind of mechanism for mediating this prudence principle divide, for avoiding. And how do they do it? Well, how does the US do it now? So a few moments on law. For those of you who are undergraduates, if you find this interesting, you should probably think about law school. If you don't, you're like the rest of the world. Okay. What does the US do now? What happened after Naim? Few things make the modern passive virtues different, okay? One, we're not so clear-cut on our rights. Right, Brown was pretty clear. It was set up. There was a sense that you knew what the court had to do in that Naim case. The court has been a little bit better about limiting its decisions. So it's not always absolutely obvious what the next principled step is. There's complications. There's more reasonable disagreement, maybe, over the meaning of rights. Guido Calabresi has said the laws involved might be moving towards unconstitutionality, but yet not be invalid. Our basic notions of rights are in transition. They're changing. So there's a mixture of this fact and the use of the doctrines available to the court. So we don't see the stark question of principle versus expediency that we saw at the beginning. It isn't obvious in this way. So what are the doctrines that the court uses? Well, they're far less dialogic, right? First of all, they're cert, shorthand for cert, shorthand form for the discretion that the court has not to hear a particular case at all, writ of certiorari, which is hard to say. They don't have to say why when they deny. This is discretion, right? They can just say, we're not going to hear it. We get 9,000 cases. Recently, we're hearing about 78. That's a lot of no's. That's a lot of no's. Then there's something called the political question doctrine. The political question doctrine is also different. This is a doctrine that says that the substantive area is not one that the court will engage with because it has been given to another entity in the federal government, usually. Political question. So I'm putting those two doctrines aside. They are passive virtues. They are a way of avoiding. But what I'm interested in is what happens when you have a case, when the court is going, has the right to decide the substantive issue, but then they realize maybe it's not such a good idea. These doctrines are called justiciability doctrines. Can you hear the case at all? They're doctrines that prevent the court from opining on subject matters that aren't properly presented to it. In this way, they're considered doctrines of restraint, but they're flexible. Some are prudential, some are constitutionally required. I won't get into that. But their application has been varied, and there is this flexibility inherent in these doctrines. What are they? So one, are the right parties before the court? Do you have a concrete and particularized injury that is traceable to the challenged conduct and is likely to be redressed by a favorable judicial decision? You don't have to remember any of that. That is called standing. Is the issue real? Is it something that's actually happening, or does it depend on contingent developments in the future? That's called ripeness. If the court decides an issue, will it have any effect? Right? If not, mootness. Over time, in the past 30 years, these doctrines of justiciability have developed detailed case laws and analysis within each doctrinal strand. And there are more. There are all sorts of other kinds of ways, abstention doctrines, qualified immunity doctrines, and other fun things. But with these tools, the court in the United States is unlikely to fall into the trap of principle on the underlying substantive issue. Okay. So we're going to evaluate how we think about these modern passive virtues. So accepting now that we're in a world of strategic institutional legitimation, I hope you're all with me enough get that far. What's the problem now? Well, the passive virtues now fail not in a decision to account for expediency as well as principle, we're okay with that, but in what Deborah Hellman calls the covert deployment of prudential considerations. As Gunther and Hellman and others have noted in True Distress, Bickel's theory actually requires the judges to lie. Concerns about candor, right, tap into these questions of legal realism. What is it that's really driving judges' decision making? Arthur S. Miller, referred to a squid jurisprudence, right? Judges discharge an impenetrable cloud of ink, hide what they're really doing. But we know that judgments still do some work, right? We haven't given up, we haven't thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Judgments matter. Reasoned decision making remains a crucial prong of this endeavor. And many contend that this value cannot be realized in the absence of candor. So let's talk about candor. Candor. Candor has a distinct normative status in law. Why? Well, you might think it would start from the moral duty of persons, but then you wouldn't be a legal academic. Legal academics usually assert this without doing any of the moral reasoning that it would entail. Is candor inherently desirable as an end or as it means? They say things like, candor is a self-evident truth of uncompromising importance. And then move on. That said, non-consequentialist arguments are rarely embraced or even properly presented. Kant makes a few footnotes once in a while. But usually the literature focuses on the harms of lying rather than the value of truth. And as I am not a moral philosopher, I will focus on the points made in pragmatic analysis of candor, particularly as it applies to judges. So what are principles of candor? Principle of publicity. So this is very much tied to the idea of restraining judicial power. It's even broader, right? Public reason giving as essential to democracy, rooted in Plato's critiques of rhetoric. You can think about how core this is. Public reason giving and judicial reason giving is a way of providing accountability in an institution that is otherwise not known for accountability. It provides notice, guidance, prediction. You can understand what's coming. And all of this builds up to trust, right? And this drives the legitimacy connection. The suspicion that would exist in the absence of candor would undermine coordination. We would be in a world of prisoners' dilemmas. We would undermine not just the rule of law, but all of society. So these are powerful arguments. When you start to think about an obligation or a duty of judicial candor, things get a little bit trickier. What would the definition be? So Scott Eidelman proposes full disclosure of relevant information. If upon hearing that, you thought full disclosure, relevant information, then you're a lawyer, right? We have a problem. That's a hard thing to define. And then we have another question. Is it objective or is it subjective? A lot of people argue, well, there should be a subjective understanding. We should encourage judges to have more self-awareness about what it is they're doing. But the literature is mixed. Some people say if you encourage judges to plumb the depths of their biases, you'll never reach bottom. They'll never be able to decide anything. Of course, there are reasons against candor. Again, you know, pragmatic. It might be clearer if you're not candid. It could get quite confusing. If you have a multi-member court, you might not want candor. You need to get a majority to agree on something. There are strategic reasons in terms of paternalistic accounts, if you think of the public interest, secrecy. And there are some normative arguments as well, right? If you're, as a judge, you're confronted with what to do about a moral right and a legal right, you have some kind of moral exigency question. You might want to mask a value conflict. Philip Bobbitt and Guido Calabresi say, you know, this is those tragic choices. Subterfuge might be warranted in those times. But it's not really discussed in terms of legitimacy, at least in talking about candor in a negative way. All the arguments for legitimacy seem to be on the side of more light, more explanation, more candor. This is taking us a bit of far afield, but now that we have a sense of what's going on with the candor conversation, what's interesting about the literature on the passive virtues is no one has bothered to find out if courts can actually be candid. Just assume, well, this is better. But here, comparative analysis helps us. We can find another court that is, in fact, candid about what it's doing. We look to Europe. So let us turn to the European Convention of Human Rights. A few words on the European Convention system before we start. 1949 is when it's created. After World War II, 10 nations get together and form the Council of Europe. This is not the European Union or the European Council, which I'm sure everyone in here knows, but is in fact part of the website on the Council of Europe page explaining that they are different. Do not get confused is the actual link. Okay, so this is different, all right? The primary goal of the European Council, the Council of Europe when it was formed, was to compose a human rights charter. The charter entered into force in 1953, and now there are 47 signatories. All sorts of rights protecting states. Right? States that are in often before the court, Italy, something about delayed judicial processes, things go slowly there. Azerbaijan and Russia have been known to be seen before the court. Today we're going to talk about the UK. The idea is, right, the idea of this human rights charter was we're going to both try to do something to provide a check on individual European states, so many of which had failed devastatingly to protect human rights during World War II, and to avoid the slide into totalitarianism that happened in Germany, where it happened conforming to domestic law. So now, good political scientists, you will say, well, this is different. How can we do this comparison? And yes, there are obvious differences presented in Europe, and it is hard otherwise to create an experiment to do something like this. So we need to do our best with what we have. The comparison, I think, is useful, and we can talk more about it in the Q&A if you'd like. I've argued elsewhere that the European Convention system is both quasi-federal and quasi-constitutional in important ways that make it useful for comparison with the US Supreme Court. The court has constitutionalized the convention. It shifted it away from traditional international law, which tends to address reciprocal engagements between states, to a instrument of public order that's taken on the role of a Bill of Rights. Individuals can access the court directly. So again, this is something different from an international court, which usually has states as parties. Other people as well, I'm not alone, other people also compare the US to the US. So that's always helpful in these things, right? Misery loves company. So the critical issue here, going to the European Court of Human Rights, is that the court's toolkit is pretty limited. It's a quasi-constitutional court in a system of nation states, and it faces considerable challenges. It's reliant on the goodwill of the member states to enforce its decisions and ensure its rulings are carried out. It has some support from an institution called the Committee of Ministers, but not much. It can't rely on real federal level government to support it. There are no boots on the ground. And it has a tough job. Views on the scope and definition of human rights are varied and also may often be in opposition. So we're talking particularly about these cases of human rights where there's reasonable disagreement and a threat, because it's something so core, that compliance is going to be at issue. So the European Court of Human Rights has to reconcile its duty to provide content and scope to protected rights with its responsibility to maintain sufficient institutional legitimacy and strength to ensure adequate compliance. A tall order. What has it done? It has turned to a prudential mechanism to aid it in its efforts to escape adjudicating certain questions. Unlike the passive virtues, however, this margin of appreciation doctrine is a straightforward and candid acceptance of the majoritarian constraints on the judiciary. So what is it and how does it work? Comes from the French, like all good things here in Quebec, right? And it's an administrative law concept of discretion that's shared by many civil law jurisdictions. It's been developed into something different by the European Court. It means breathing room, discretion, sometimes translated as elbow room. To understand how it's used, we first need to spend 1 second on how rights are determined in the convention system. This should maybe be familiar to you. It's like the Canadian Charter, in that protected rights may be limited by government action taken in accordance with law, if that limitation is necessary in a democratic society and in furtherance of a legitimate interest. Okay, how does that work? Case comes before the court. The court says, okay, yes, there's a right here, but the government can impinge on that right here because the action is taken in accordance with law and the limitation is necessary in a democratic society in furtherance of a legitimate aim. Where does the margin of appreciation come into play? Well, as it's doing that analysis and it gets usually to the necessary in a democratic society part, the court says, the state thinks it's necessary, so we'll defer to the state here. It's within the state's margin of appreciation to apply this limitation. Now, you might say at this stage, well, no, Aaron, that's principle. The court is recognizing that it is for the nation state to decide these issues. It's closer to the ground. This is a comparative institutional capacity question. This is subsidiarity at work. No. You're wrong. That's not how the margin works. I'll explain how, and then you'll see why that story is not compelling. So here's an example of the margin sort of at its best, in a more Beckelian passive virtue than even Bickel's passive virtues themselves. It's a dialogic development of rights protection. So, more stories. 1986, you're in the UK. Not eating beef, I hope. A man named Mark Rees had been born Brenda, and he sought to change the sex designation on his birth certificate. And the UK Register refused. Register General refused. So he challenged this before the European Court of Human Rights as a violation of, among other things, his Article 8 right to family life. Respect for family life and privacy. The court finds no violation. It determines, having, critical point, regard to the diversity of practices followed in the convention system in the member states, the law was within the UK's margin of appreciation. The court noted, however, it was conscious of the seriousness of the problems affecting transsexuals and that the need for appropriate legal measures should be kept in mind. 1990, 4 years later, same issue. Caroline Cossey, prevented from marrying a man because her birth certificate still had her sex as a man and it would have been a same-sex marriage. She goes to the European Court of Human Rights again. European Court of Human Rights says, within the UK's margin of appreciation, we're monitoring developments, but there's still little ground among the member states. So the 1986 decision was 12-3. 1992, France, same issue. Again, court says, well, things are changing, but not yet a sufficient consensus between the member states. It finds a partial violation, though, because in France, you couldn't even change your first name. And in Britain, you could do that. So they say, well, this is out of the norm. This is a violation. You can change your first name. 1998, once again, we're back in the UK. Same issue. Once again, margin of appreciation. The court reminds the UK that it told it to keep the area under review. Doesn't really seem like the UK is doing that. Obviously. and that consensus in the member states is shifting. 2002, Christine Goodwin versus United Kingdom. The United Kingdom can no longer rely on a margin of appreciation in this area. The decision is unanimous. Okay, so this story clearly shows it's not about comparative expertise or comparative competence, because the margin can narrow over time. As consensus builds around the scope of a particular right, the margin narrows. Why would you get to know what was necessary in democratic society in 1986, but you no longer have that competency in 2002? Well, it's because what's necessary in a democratic society has changed at a European-wide level, according to the court. So the scope of the deference can fluctuate from right to right, or more accurately, from limitation to limitation on the rights, and even from country to country. So the court has deferred to Turkey's margin of appreciation in certain criminal rights cases, but not to Scotland or the UK's. It's interesting. So the court here, right, in a happy story, it's trying to promote consensus. It's a dialogic approach. It's allowing for participation in the elaboration and application of the norm by the member states themselves. What about compliance? So Yuval Shani suggests that this might be bolstering the court's legitimacy. He says compliance with low-cost judgments, read no-cost judgments, right, might have bolstered the court's legitimacy capital such that it eventually is able to issue higher-cost judgments, affording member states a narrower margin of appreciation. There is a lot of flagging for the member state what's coming down the pike. But we don't want to overstate this compliance. A recent study by Larry Helfer and Eric Voden suggests that at most the court influences countries to adopt changing their laws, to adopt changes a little bit in advance of when they would have done so anyway. It's not leading the trend in rights-enhancing policy adoption. And this makes some sense, right? Given that one of the core elements of this margin analysis is based on consensus. Is it compliance or is it peer pressure? We're not sure. But the court serves as the moderator of this rights debate. It does get to set the agenda, and it might get to set the time limit for discussion. You ask what happens when there is no European consensus. For example, religious freedom. For example, the French principle of laïcité or the Turkish principle. Well, that means that public bans on headscarves can be upheld within the state's margin of appreciation, or crosses can be left in classrooms in Italy because that's within a state's margin of appreciation. And we have no anticipation of consensus ever coming in these areas in our lifetime. I mean, that's negative. Maybe. Who knows? But probably not. So these margins of appreciation are unlikely to be narrowed over time. The countries can do what they can do. So what is this? This is a doctrinal instantiation of majoritarianism. It is a candid acceptance of the institutional weakness that the courts have, and it shifts as norms evolve. The court can avoid a substantive decision on the scope of a right by recognizing that for the moment, it is within the nation's discretion to impinge upon that right, but without affirmatively legitimating that decision or supporting the limitation. And there's flexibility over time. So the margin of appreciation is an open and candid acknowledgement of the limits of judicial power rather than its extent. Okay, so to come to conclusion. People said in name that that decision could have undermined legitimacy. It was so obvious what the court did. Showing that the court acts strategically is itself delegitimizing. Well, that's too simplistic a critique, because the European system and some compliance in the European system shows, right? But what are the critiques of the margin? What happens in the convention system? Well, the major criticism is that the European Court is abdicating its judicial responsibility to provide an autonomous interpretation of convention rights. The margin is a substitute for coherent legal analysis. Okay, this might be an argument from principle. Maybe the argument is that the court isn't sufficiently protecting rights. We can't evaluate that in any individual case, though. What could it have done differently? Would it have had compliance? What would it have been like? But to take a step back and look at it from a broader vantage point of institutional legitimacy and the role of the court, I propose to you that what the margin of appreciation approach does, or why it's problematic, is because it is both a doctrine and candid. So the combination of candor and a consensus-based methodology undermines the potential of the court to function as a counter-majoritarian influence. Back to the ideas of law, back to doctrine. Why does doctrine matter? It's core in legal reasoning. You can't get around it. You try, that's the whole game. But the idea of doctrine is that it's going to constrain decision-making and function as notice, very similar to the ideas of candor. It provides benefits of predictability and certainty. In the U.S., doctrine is further supported by the concept of stare decisis, which is a principle that judges are obligated to follow earlier case law. The double dose of candor and doctrine make it very difficult for the court to ever use its institutional legitimacy if, in fact, it is building that legitimacy up. It becomes very difficult when you're using a majoritarian construct to get out of it. The times when you most want people to comply, when you are finally being counter-majoritarian, is the time where you are obviously not following your own stated doctrine. So what you're losing here is the counter-majoritarian aspiration. We hear a lot about the counter-majoritarian difficulty. But if we buy this idea of constitutional rights and constitutional courts, the counter-majoritarian aspiration should matter. What are the benefits of passive virtues? Again, I think the value is in the doctrine, the fact that these are doctrines of judiciability. But these doctrines stem in part from an assertion of power. Oh, we could do so much, but we're limiting ourselves through these doctrines of judiciability. And because it's a doctrine, and it's been developed over the past 30 years, it's thick and it's complicated. If doctrine itself has a legitimizing effect, the amount and the intricacy of this secondary jurisprudence might also serve to enhance institutional legitimacy. Why? Well, it helps us solve our candor problem. At least one version of candor. Mathilde Cohen has suggested that we should think about candor in a slightly different way. We should think about it as sincerity. And to distinguish justificatory reasons from motives. A decision maker, she says, is sincere when she gives reasons that she thinks really justify the outcomes. She doesn't need, in addition, to be motivated by those reasons. It's sufficient that she believes the reasons she puts forward are good reasons. What does this mean practically? Well, it means that in the justiciability doctrine story, the court not only can avoid raising the question of principle on the underlying substantive right, it might be able to avoid demonstrating avoidance at all. So if you'll give me 5 more minutes, we can conclude the way we began, which is with a case about marriage, right? 2013. Supreme Court decided a case called Hollingsworth versus Perry. And as you probably know, the core question, the underlying substantive rights question, was whether or not there was a due process or equal protection right under the U.S. Constitution to marry the person of your choosing, regardless of sex. In case you hadn't heard, the United States is divided on that issue. So the court grants cert on the case from California. So now it has it. Could have denied cert, but it did, granted it. What had happened in the case was that a group supporting marriage as an institution reserved for opposite-sex couples supported a ballot initiative, the famous Prop 8, that changed the constitution of the state to this end. Prop 8 passed, and it was challenged on a number of constitutional grounds, as well as others, including these violations of the U.S. Constitution. The trial court said it was unconstitutional, and the decision was appealed. Who appealed the decision? The state decided, we're not interested in supporting this anymore. We're happy that you found this unconstitutional. We're out. So the people that had intervened in the trial litigation, proponents of the ballot initiative, were allowed to bring the case forward on appeal. The appellate court of appeals, concluded that Prop 8 was unconstitutional. They apply to the Supreme Court. Note that the state of California concluded that these proponents of Prop 8 were allowed to bring the appeal. So under California law, this is okay. So we're hearing the case. We're there. We're in oral argument. They get an hour. 10 minutes are spent on standing. 50 minutes, the rest of the time, is talking about the underlying rights question. And there's some indication in oral argument that the justices might have been having a bit of buyer's remorse. Justice Kennedy expressed his view that the underlying issue, well, was really in flux, wasn't it? And Justice Ginsburg, actually not in oral argument, but at other times in public comments, was doing a lot of talking about Roe v. Wade, a lot of talking about jumping in to heated and ongoing political issues that are unresolvable, might undermine the court's legitimacy, not connecting it in any way, of course, but just talking about it. The blogosphere is alight. Everyone says passive virtues, passive virtues, passive virtues. What happens? We get a decision on standing. The court had to determine whether or not the proponents of Prop 8 had that concrete and cognizable injury, et cetera, I said before. As a matter of standing law, the issue could have gone either way. There's so much standing law in so many different areas, and they pulled it from everywhere. Deciding that there was no standing, the court didn't have jurisdiction to hear the case. So Mike Klarman, the law professor who's generally skeptical, said the court's never ruled on the specific standing question. Quote, one cannot casually disparage the decision in the same way that commentators assailed the court's dodge of the miscegenation issue in the 1950s. And it was an odd lineup. It didn't look right, right? We had Roberts and Scalia with Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan. Those are conservatives and liberals all mixed up. And on the other side, Kennedy and Sotomayor and Thomas and Alito. There was no story there. The narrative was lost. So the idea is this robust secondary jurisprudence of the passive virtues, stemming from the court's strength rather than weakness, allows the judges to engage with reason giving and in other area of law in a way that's distinguishable from pure strategy. This might be particularly important in a system like the United States, where there is interpretive and ideological variation, to put it mildly, on the court. If ideological incongruence is one of the things that undermines the legitimacy, we want to minimize its evidence. And here, passive virtues gives the justices deep cover when interpretive theory and principled interpretation conflict with prudential considerations. Ultimately, we don't know for sure whether or not the court used the passive virtues at all. And that may be their strength, leaving the counter-majoritarian aspiration alive. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
At these lectures, the first question is reserved for a member of the Research Group on Constitutional Studies Student Fellowship. Everyone, please turn on your microphone when you ask a question.
Thanks for an excellent presentation. This discussion relates, I think, a lot of questions of progressive rulings that might not be plausible when the power or the public opinion at the time is against them. Are there any examples in your research of rulings that go the other way, of things that were controversial where a state or a country in Europe had a court that ruled in a progressive fashion that was ruled down by the higher up court in what you might say is a retrograde fashion. So have you seen examples where courts would take, say, the Virginia example, and hiding from the judgment, instead of passing a progressive judgment, ruled on the side of racist marriage law, for instance?
Thank you very much. So, it's a bit of a complicated question in Europe, right? Because decisions are made at the state level, and so it's usually the person whose right is being violated that then goes up to the European level to ask for benefits there. So if they get it at the state level, that's an interaction between the individual and the nation state. The member state doesn't then go to the European Court of Human Rights. The member state probably appoints different judges the next time it has the opportunity to do judicial appointments, but that's a different question. One of the challenges here, the progressive rulings idea, is what does it mean to be progressive? And in the United States, it's complicated, right? What about property rights? So we've gotten to a situation where if you believe in individual rights and property rights is an important right, well, the court isn't enforcing that in the way maybe that some people think it should be. So one challenge is in defining what we mean by progressive, and oftentimes that can be intention. Another is when you deal with two rights at the same time. Right? What happens when you have a right to equal protection, and you are a black school child, and you have a right to freedom of association, and you are a white parent? Right? What do we think about when those two rights go up against one another? Well, the U.S. does something really clever, which is deny that that happens. The U.S. Supreme Court is uncomfortable with competing rights claims, so it works its way around them. You end up having a right and a set of interests, which aren't really rights, and so it becomes complicated in the way that they deal with that. That's something you see a lot more in the European system, and I think the margin of appreciation is actually used there to allow for nation states within Europe to make that balance of competing rights themselves. There isn't a one-way, one question, is there a one-way ratchet, right? Or is there a one-way ratchet of rights? And this is the one area in the U.S. that really uses consensus is in the Eighth Amendment, what is cool and unusual. And it uses consensus in a very different way. It's not really used constrain the court. It's used because the word reasonable or concept of reasonableness is in the Constitution, so the court wants to give content to that and looks to see what is happening within the country. And the court's also very clear to say, and we will make our own reasoned decision as well. It's part of the Eighth Amendment analysis. But when it looks to consensus, Justice Scalia complains a lot because it seems to be a one-way ratchet. Once you have said, you know, you cannot, it is cruel and unusual to use the death penalty for someone who has committed child rape. If consensus shifts, how do you shift that rule back? So Justice Scalia doesn't like consensus precisely because of this challenge of a one-way ratchet. Once you've established a right, once you've established a norm, it becomes very difficult to shift that and change that away, because to pass those laws are already in violation of the law as it stands. It's a partial answer.
Many years ago, I came to know that at least in some Swiss courts, deliberations of the members of the court had to be in public. I wondered whether you had ever looked at that. What does it do? Are they deterred from any sort of frank deliberation? Do they exchange their views over the cell phone, or by email, or over dinner?
Secretly.
Yeah, is this entirely inhibiting? And if such a rule were proposed in the United States, what do you suppose would be the response to it in different parts of the U.S. and at different levels, and would you yourself freak out over it because it would, in effect, damage the possibility of subterfuge?
It's always nice to be in a position where you're defending subterfuge. Great, very interesting point about Switzerland. I did not know that. I have a friend who just finished a, Mathilde Cohen, I mentioned her, she's just published an article in the American Journal of Comparative Law where she looks at decision-making processes in a comparative perspective to see how those decisions and the way in which the judges deliberate affects the result. So she describes the Anglo-American system as deciding after you decide. So you hear the argument, they come together, they decide on a result, and then they decide how they're going to justify that result. And the French and some of the European courts, who they decide before they decide. They write the opinion and discuss it and decide on the draft, and then they go to oral argument, and then they officially decide that that's what they're going to do and publish the opinion. So one question is, as you think about institutional design questions, at what stage of which courts is the public deliberation known? If you were in, for example, a court which the deciding before you decided happened behind closed doors, and then the conference was open, and you said, well, this is what we're deciding, and here's our decision, that might not be so problematic. But if it's the negotiations and that side of it, I think you would see how the sausage is made, and that might be problematic. When I clerked on the court, I had gone, having done a PhD in political science, and gone to law school. And I, you know, political science, they teach you, it's all attitude. They, you know, and you get there, and I was pleasantly surprised. Oh, no, there's a lot of law. They actually are constrained. But some of my colleagues who had just gone to law school were devastated. They were devastated by the fact that the law runs out, particularly at a court, at the highest court in a political system. And at some point, decisions need to be made and discretion needs to be used. So I don't know, given the fact that 50% of the U.S. and there's still this myth of legality, and it matters to know that principle is relevant. I don't know if showing that it's a mix would reinforce that or would undermine that. Probably the latter.
I was wondering if your research had looked at all into the question of constitutional remedies and how courts use those to build legitimacy. I know it's a big role in Canada. I'm not sure how much it plays in the United States.
That is an excellent question, and I hope is going to be my next paper with Dean and Frady right behind you. We have been talking about that exact question, about how remedies are used in some systems. So what maybe I have here is the ex ante story. What do you do beforehand, or what do you do to try to avoid the substantive issue? And then there's maybe another story, which is we've decided the substantive issue, but we're going to fashion a remedy in a way that structures compliance successfully. One of the reasons that this isn't often seen in the United States is because of a case that I did not mention, but that will leap to mind for you maybe, which is Brown 2, not Brown 1, Brown 2, which is the remedial decision in which the court says that desegregation should proceed with all deliberate speed. That remedial solution really didn't work until Lyndon Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act. So that is a different kind of remedy. That is a political legislative remedy. So I think the U.S. court is maybe a little less interested in playing at the remedial side.
So before we talk about the decision-making process in general, my question relates to institutional design and the administrative process that brings about the selection of judges and what impact that can have on the system. So particularly in Canada, we're playing around with a few reforms right now. We had sort of an incident at the political level recently. Now the selection process for the Supreme Court, for example, is quite opaque. So these are sort of current questions that Canada is dealing with. In the U.S., of course, there is the option of electing judges as well, which is a different model. So my question is, how does the selection of judges have an impact on the legitimacy of the judiciary in general?
That's a fantastic question. What you've raised is a tremendous amount to unpack, right? How do we understand the legitimacy of the judiciary? Right. If we're concerned about the counter-majoritarian difficulty, the fact that it is a non-democratic body, then we have to think about accountability, political accountability in the inputs, how it is constructed. People might be so worried about its counter-majoritarian nature or the fact that it is not politically accountable that they elect their judges. That is terrible. I just had to say that. It's terrible, right? Because then you've given up the whole idea of having a court do something if you've elected your judges. Justice O'Connor goes on about this at great length. But the problem there, right, is still that there's a democratic legitimacy issue with an appointed court. So what are the solutions? Tom Ginsburg and Nino Garupa have an article where they talk about independence and accountability. You want an independent court that can do its court work unimpeded by political actors, so you don't want it to be elected, but you want that court to be accountable. And what happens in most societies is you see a cyclical relationship. So we get worried about how much influence our political actors have on our court, and we move towards independence. And maybe we create a judicial appointments commission, or we do something to take it out of the hands of those terrible politicians. And then the court starts deciding things like rights. And all of a sudden we realize, wait a minute, they're not elected. This is very uncomfortable. And we start rethinking about, well, how do we bring back in accountability? Maybe politicians should be involved. Maybe we should have some sense. So the answer to your question is unsatisfying, right? Because at some level, it's different in every different society as they make that set of balances and they play around with different institutional design mechanisms in order to make it work. What the article shows, and what I think is very interesting, is that it's very hard to reach some sort of stable equilibrium. And it just keeps coming back. And the only way you can really reach a stable equilibrium is by removing a lot of what the court decides. Right? If you take away rights, if you take away some of the issues that create the political dissatisfaction and the concern, then you can have a system that's pretty stable. But what you want the court to be doing is intricately connected with who you want on it and how you want them to function and how you want to appoint them or hold them accountable.
Thank you, Aaron. It's a very interesting talk. I had a question about incrementalism, because it strikes me that that might be kind of a hybrid case. So it's a standard doctrine that courts shouldn't decide more than they need to in order to resolve a case, at least in common law countries. And that could be for a bunch of reasons. So in a way, that's ducking an issue. But they do decide the case. They just don't decide as much as they might. It could be that that leads to stability. You may get fewer overrulings. It could be that you reduce your error rate. It could be that you hold out hope for other people on the court that maybe they'll win the next one, or for other people in the polity that it will go differently next time. In effect, you're adding to legitimacy on one level, or actually in several different ways, but you are also ducking the overall issue if we know where the court's going to eventually go, and I'm wondering if that fits your picture or if you think there's a different phenomenon going on there.
It's an interesting question because on one hand, the dialogic model or the idea that things can develop over time is complemented by incrementalism. That sounds similar. I think the challenge to it is how incremental can you be? And so it doesn't exactly fit the model of avoidance if the case as it's presented is such that it's hard to be incremental. So I guess the answer might be it will depend on the kind of right and the way in which it's presented to the court if it can functionally be incremental in that kind of situation. Oftentimes, these rights claims are not fact-bound, right? It's unlikely that the court is going to say something particularly narrow to, well, you might be able to marry this type of person at this time or this. It's hard to cabin them in that way. So the incrementalism that you see in other areas of the common law doesn't work as well in rights claims. In fact, one of the big challenges to the court, you know, Casey is a court decision in the U.S. that's the follow-on to Brown, to Roe. It's the case where they actually thought that they were gonna overturn Roe v. Wade, and they don't. And what they try to do is back away from the scope of the right that was granted in Roe and nuance it and say, well, you can limit a woman's right to access an abortion as long as it's not a substantial burden. Trying to back away from the scoping right, maybe almost a reverse attempt at incrementalism. And Justice Scalia castigates the plurality for doing this because he says, that's not how we think about rights. We don't think about rights this way. Once you have a right, we define it, and we give it strict scrutiny. We're going to not allow any limitations. Now, sidebar, of course, he does the same thing in the Second Amendment case about the right to bear arms, where he puts a whole lot of strange qualifiers in there that sort of undermine. But in any event, right, it's difficult to do, but that's sort of the core idea about what they're trying to do in the right. So it's helpful, but I'm not sure that it solves the avoidance problem enough to outweigh the use of our core passive virtues, our core disability doctrines.
Thank you. Wonderful talk. So I would love to hear you express what exactly it is that the court fears. Right? So you talk about legitimacy as this kind of budget that the court earns and then they spend it when they mm-hmm. want to. And what happens when the court goes into, you know, legitimacy bankruptcy? So it seems that you mostly focus on compliance. Is it limited to just compliance? And here's a funny question. If it's down to compliance, why should the court be all that concerned about compliance? And so my point is that the whole institution is constructed in such a way as to insulate it from things like possibly compliance, right? So when you think of your first Virginia example, right, the court there has everything on their side. They have fresh precedent, they have stare decisis, they have life tenure, so they don't need to worry about that. And yet, they fear it, right? And it's quite understandable. But I'd like you to because I don't think there's a full consensus on it, what's your view as to exactly what's at stake for the court?
Okay, so in this project, I've been talking a lot about compliance of individuals, right? Imagine what happens after Brown and we have people protesting, preventing children and young adults from going to elementary school, going to college, that kind of protest. Compliance also can be at a whole nother level, right? Particularly in a federal system where you have states that are structured as states with powers of lawmaking capacity and over some not inconsiderable force, police forces, that you can actually have compliance structured in a state system that is even more threatening to the rule of law. This is all coming back to the rule of law, of course. And then you can also think about compliance of other actors. Does the president comply? Does Congress comply? So we can think about compliance writ large. So maybe you say, well, I'm not so worried about some of this low-level compliance, but maybe you are worried if a state decides not to comply or Congress decides not to comply or the president decides not to comply? And why are you worried about that? Why do we care? Well, the judges, individually, you suggest, well, they have life tenure, they have nice offices. Well, maybe they don't care. But the idea of what the rule of law is meant to provide is that people follow it, right? And that the court is a function in society that constructs and constrains society in important ways. What happens when you don't have compliance? You might not have any check on the political branches at all, right? So Hungary is a lovely example. The court in Hungary was created after the fall of the wall, and it starts out and it looks quite powerful. It's passing handing down a lot of decisions that seem counter-majoritarian, it seems powerful, but it doesn't really have any built-up legitimacy. So when it produces a decision that goes against Viktor Orban, Viktor Orban can say, no, I'm not going to follow that. I'm going to strip your jurisdiction. Well, then what happens? Is there a popular uprising? Do people say, you can't do that? This is the court. No, the court is what is going to give some limitation on what happens to you. No, nothing happens. It's over. Now, that's an extreme example, right? And maybe nothing would ever happen in an example where you have that amount of support. You think about the slide. We talked about the slide into totalitarianism in Germany, right? You can envision these stories. But what you want is an institution that does matter. So in the U.S. example, the court was much reviled in the 1930s. And Franklin Roosevelt swept to victory. Right? Huge majorities. And he said, I'm going to pack the court. I'm going to change the institutional nature of the court, and I'm going to make it an institution that's going to support me and what I'm trying to do here. Now, a lot of people say, well, the court backed down. It's a famous story. There's a switch in time. One person switches vote, and it's called the switch in time that saved nine. Famous headline, you know. But in historical research, actually, it shows the measure was wildly unpopular in Congress, in the Senate. People didn't like it. People thought, no, wait a minute, you don't go messing around with the court. We don't like that. Even though we have specific dislike about some of these specific decisions, support was weak, the diffuse support that the court had engendered was enough to let it ride out that storm. So if you think that separation of powers matters, if you think that the court can do something to protect both individual liberties and to limit governmental power, and that's a critical aspect of both the rule of law and a political system, you want the court to have legitimacy. And if it's undermined, then it's not going to be able to be there when it needs to. Or more importantly, the people aren't going to ensure that it remains there when it's under threat.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you. I just wanted to maybe ask two related questions. The first being if you could elaborate a bit more on the comparison between Europe and America, because it seems to me one of the major stumbling blocks to that comparison would be this idea that you have a United States Supreme Court as part of the Constitution and sort of within the nation state and has a claim on the sovereign power of the executive, whereas in the European case, they're just signatories, which isn't quite as strong a relationship. So to comment on that. And then the second issue would be whether or not you would agree that the comparison now would be more interesting with Europe because the European Union has put the convention inside its legal framework. And so whether or not the relationship between EU member states and the court would change because of that, as opposed to, say, between the court and Russia or Azerbaijan or something like that. Thank you.
Thank you. So on your second point, absolutely. I think the real question there is going to be, how does the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, and the European Court of Human Rights in these two different systems engage with one another's jurisprudence? And because we don't know that answer until we know that, it's hard to know if the comparison would be more or less useful. In some ways, we would expect to see if the ECJ takes on more of a rights-giving role, we would expect to see more compliance, perhaps better, a different set of avoidance doctrines, because there is already more compliance with EU law, and there isn't another set of law in the European Convention system, another weakness in some ways of the comparison with the Convention system, which I acknowledge. But we don't know yet, so we would have to wait. An interesting thing about the European Court of Justice and that system is the way that it's structured and the way that the European Court uses the nation-state courts. And in that way, it's a bit similar to the European Court of Human Rights, in that there's a relationship that the court needs between itself and the courts in the member states. They work together, and they need to keep each other, mainly the European Court of Human Rights, needs to keep the courts of the member states on side to make sure things are actually happening. It's a little bit easier in the U.S. system, where you have a whole federal court system, where you can take these claims away from the states and address them in the federal court system. I'm not sure which way that cuts, though, because you would think, well, surely the U.S. Supreme Court then has a lot more capacity to be candid about when it's unwilling to make a decision. It already has a lot of diffuse support. It does have power if the executive is willing to use it. You said it has a claim on the sovereign power. That claim is by permission, right? Rather than inherent. It has neither, right? Neither force nor will. Don't forget that. So maybe, but I'm not sure which way it cuts. Your bigger challenge to just the whole endeavor of comparing the U.S. to the European Court of Human Rights, you know, I fully take that on board, right? There are a lot of differences. There are a lot of problems in terms of, I think most relevant is the fact that the European Court of Human Rights doesn't also get to make decisions about what we would consider federal level law. So one of the benefits that the U.S. Supreme Court has is it can say to a state like California, we're not going to decide this yet, but when Congress passes the Defense of Marriage Act, we can give you some hints, maybe this is Andrew's incrementalism, we can give you some hints about what we're thinking through this mechanism. So not only do they have, they kind of can play two games at the same time. And the European Court of Human Rights can. That said, I think an earlier Supreme Court, I mean, if you look back at the history, it is uncertain until Eisenhower sends in the troops to Little Rock whether he's going to send in those troops and enforce the Supreme Court decision. Eisenhower himself personally did not think Brown was the right decision. So you don't. So maybe when you think about it today, well, hard to make the comparison. But certainly in earlier times in U.S. history, that diffuse support hadn't been as built up. And really the goal of the comparison isn't so much to say that this is some sort of transportation or one system should use the other system or anything like that, but to show that it is possible to have a candid acceptance of your institutional weakness, and that there are some positives to that story. It might engender some compliance. You might get a more dialogic way of evaluating and constructing rights, but that there are also some things that are lost in that system, and this counter-majoritarian aspiration is clearly lost. The response to that is, well, maybe you can never really have it in the first place. Right? So Barry Friedman or Mike Klarman, who I cited, would say the court never really is counter-majoritarian. It's always constrained by how much people can accept. And maybe that's true, but it would be pretty to think that it's not.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to your bookends and about to what extent can you compare the 1950 case in Virginia to the current decision of the Supreme Court not to hear the same-sex marriage. It seems to this they're different. I mean, it seems, from what I understand, the Supreme Court in the 50s, it was pretty clear that they felt that this was an immoral type of act, the Anti-Miscegenation Act, but they were very politically weak because they would have to override the court decision. There was really massive resistance, as you pointed out,
right,
on the state level. They didn't have the support of Eisenhower, as you just mentioned. They didn't even know if they would get this, if they get the support. So it's really moral certainty versus overridden by strong political weakness. I don't think that's a situation with the same sex. First of all, they probably would have, if they would have taken it, they probably would have upheld the state courts. There doesn't seem, even though there's a lot of debate about it, you don't seem to have the massive political pushback against the same court decisions. You would have the support of the executive had they decided. Maybe here they actually felt that it wasn't such a clear-cut issue morally, constitutionally, and that's why they didn't want to get involved. I'm just sort of thinking out loud.
So I like the way you're thinking out loud. Thank you. So it's a point-counterpoint. Let's play with the idea. So on one hand, right, maybe that's right, but we have the Windsor decision that comes down at the same time, that decision I was talking to you about DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level. And the court in that decision lines it up pretty well, suggesting that it's going to be very hard to make an argument against same-sex marriage. And in fact, because of that decision, all of these federal courts have been overturning state bans on same-sex marriage using Windsor. Right? That's been happening all the time, and recently the court denied cert. It's not going to hear them. Thank you very much. Right? So I'm not sure it's as clear as you are, maybe, that we know which way the breakdown would have been under on this underlying substantive issue. And I think we have a question about, but the point, your next point, is how bad would it have been? If they had decided in Hollingsworth versus Perry that there is a constitutional protection to marry the person of your choosing, would there have been mass pandemonium? Could they have ridden out the storm? What would have happened? And that gets back to one of the questions that I asked you to assume away, which was, very useful thing to do, everyone, which was that the court would know the right time to use the power. And so maybe one of the stories about Hollingsworth versus Perry is that this was a time they could have done it, but they didn't. And if not now, when will they do it? So it could actually be an even starker and more depressing story than your original comment.
One comment and one quick question from me before we adjourn. The comment is that there's something very appropriate about our returning to this room where Jeremy Waldron kicked off the RGCS lecture series just over 2 years ago with precisely the kind of blanket critique of constitutionalism, including the US-EU comparison, and including some commentary on the margin of appreciation in this room. The quick question, is the name of the Chinese man in the original story Say Name?
Ham Say Name, or Naim, I'm not sure.
Is this one of those urban legend Ellis Island kind of names where it sounds as if what you're saying
say
is
name.
The immigration officer said to the person,
say
name, and the person just repeated back. Or are you reading off an actual Chinese name in this story?
It's the transliteration. I don't know, but that is a wonderful idea. I'm not sure. I think he arrived in 1949 to the U.S., so Ellis Island was still going, but almost closed, so I'm not sure.
All right. With that, we invite you to join us in the lobby outside for